T-minus 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here.
Okay, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is Grant Cameron, and I have a really special show. We're all heated up in the situation with the UAPs and disclosure and the government and stuff, and I have a very timely guest. I have Dr. Mario Beauregard with me today, and we're going to talk consciousness. I know lots of times people in ufology don't want to talk this. Let me start with two quotes here. These are from high-level people in the UFO business. One is Dr. James Lakatsky. Here's what he said. Everything works as if UAP were a product of technology that integrates physical and psychic phenomena. And he's the guy who ran the program for the Defense Intelligence Agency, the UFO program. He talks about it. And the other one quote I want to do is from an interview we did with Dr. Eric Walker, who was the former president of Penn State University and was the chairman of the board of the Institute for Defense Analysis, the top military think tank in the United States. He's being interviewed back in 1990. So this is like many years ago. And the guy is asking him from Great Britain, he's asking him about the control group, the group that runs the whole show, that organizes in this very secret group. He said, are you a member of that group? And Dr. Walker says, I cannot answer that. And he said, how good is your seventh sense? How much do you know about ESP? And the interviewer says, I know to some degree about ESP and EVP. What has this got to do with UFOs? And Dr. Walker says, unless you understand about it and know how to use it, you will not be taken in by the control group. Only a very few know about it. And then he gets asked, are there any military people in the group? And he says, no. And this is the important thing, that we are looking at UFOs, and I will state backwards and forwards, there is a physical component, but there is a spiritual consciousness component. That's why my guest today is so very important. Dr. Beauregard is a Canadian neuroscientist and known for his groundbreaking work in the field of neuroscience, particularly for his research on the mind-brain connection. He has made significant contributions to the understanding of consciousness, neuroplasticity, and the nature of mind beyond the physical brain. The reason I really wanted to talk to him is because I've known for a number of years. I talked to Diane Hennessy Powell, and she mentioned to me the fact that my guest today is one of the primary authors of the Manifesto for a Post-Materialist Science. And this was done also with Rupert Sheldrake and with Gary Schwartz and a number of other people. So I'm really honored to bring someone on, because we're going to be talking, I believe, once the UFO thing gets exposed, we're going to be talking consciousness, and we're going to be talking about Mario's latest book called Expanding Reality. And that's what I basically have moved now. I don't really do that much on UFOs. I basically am concerned about one thing and one thing only: what's the nature of reality? I think we have to get there and go and figure out what's actually going on in the world. And the UFO is only one method of investigating. So good morning, good afternoon. Bonjour, comment ça va?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's the extent of my English that I learned in. Mario's from Quebec, and people who watch my interviews with Jimmy Blanchette will realize today that these guys from Quebec, I don't know whether they put something in the water, but these guys are usually ahead of the curve. Jimmy Blanchette, every time I interview him, I think I'm talking to Albert Einstein, and Mario has been ahead of the curve. So I want to start with that. In the UFO community, everybody knows the story about Dr. John Mack at Harvard University, leading psychiatrist, who they tried to pull his tenure because he sort of stepped over the line and got out of the nuts and bolts stuff. And you actually, we can start here with your background in terms of the fact that the high priest actually excommunicated you when it was time for your tenure. Can you tell that story and how you got involved in the idea of consciousness coming out of the sort of the nuts and bolts work of that others are doing on urology?
Well, I've been expelled from the University of Montreal in 2013. They refused to give me my tenure, even though I was generating a lot of publicity all over the world. But I was affiliated with the medical school, and at the medical school, they wanted me to, work with big pharma. And that was not my my plan at all as a scientist, because when I was younger, at 8 years old, I've had a profound mystical experience. To summarize it briefly, my parents, they were farmers. They were living in a place called Eastern Townships in the province of Quebec, near Vermont. And it was during the summer break. We had a small forest near the fields where the cows were. And so one day in July, it was a beautiful day. I decided to go explore the mysterious forest. I liked to do that when I was younger. And I walked for about a few hours, and then I became tired because it was quite hot. And I decided to sit on a big gray rock that was there in the middle of the forest. And after a few minutes, I started to feel that the trees, the cows, I could see also, the rock itself, myself, everything was starting to vibrate. And after, I think, what was a few minutes, I realized that the trees, the cows, the clouds, the big rock, and my small self, little Mario, we were all part of something, one whole, something that is one. And so that was a profound experience.
Can I ask a question about that? Because I've had these similar experiences. I think a lot of people in the UFO community have had, like, 37% of experiences in the UFO community have had a near-death experience, which you can talk about yours. But my question to you, based upon mine, is, well, two things. Did it come with absolute certainty, and did it change your life? Would you be who you are now if it had not? Because what my impression was, when I tell people my experience, I always say that the hardest thing to explain to you is the absolute certainty. It's like you knew it before, and they showed it to you, and you go, oh, okay, I remember that now. It's like, yes. Was it that dramatic that you it changed?
Oh, yeah. Because a few hours, and during the next few days, and even a few weeks after that, I received like a download of information about my life plan. And in the information, it was clear that I was to become a scientist who studies the brain, that I would meet with other scientists at a certain point in time in the future, and that we were going to demonstrate that the brain is the mind is not what the brain does, and consciousness is above physical matter. And this is exactly what happened 50 some years after that, almost 50 some years. Now I'm at the beginning of my 60s. It was a long time ago. But and so it was a very deep experience and very profound. Yeah, definitely.
And so you, I guess the UFO community, usually when I talk to experiencers, I'll ask them at one point, I'll say, do you think you're on a mission? And they'll usually say one of two things. They'll say, yeah, I think so, but I don't know what it is. Or they'll start telling you their mission. They become almost evangelical about what they have. So you believe this concept that this is, a lot of this stuff isn't random, that you were sort of chosen, that you were moved down a path. And from time to time, you will get sort of a nudge and directed in the right direction, correct?
Exactly. Yes. And so that's what created problem when I started to study neuroscience at the University of Montreal, because I was telling the old guard that they were mistaken about the mind-brain relationship and the nature of consciousness, that they got it all wrong since over a century. And so the, you know, that created a lot of tension. And I was trained as a neurochemist, neuropharmacologist. And so that's why the dean and all the people in the hierarchy of the medical school, they wanted me to obviously do a research project with Big Pharma, because I was trained to do this. But I had I knew that I had to conduct a number of different experiments with regard to the power of consciousness, what's happening in the brain when we have spiritual or mystical experiences, and so on and so forth. And so that didn't fit at all with their agenda for me. And so that's what created the problem. They didn't understand that. They believed that I was a nut. Yeah, really.
Yeah. Now, you were from a very famous place. Can you talk about, because people in the UFO community will know the MKUltra stuff. Now, that was way before your time, but that's where it started, where you were. And can you give me the famous line? You have this very elderly lady. What is the line she uses with that I was so amazed when she told you about giving you a warning about what was going to happen in the future?
Oh, yeah. She said, I won't name her because I think she's still alive.
I think she's still alive, yeah.
Almost 100 years old or over 100 years old. But she said, as long as I'm here, I will not allow any type of experiment at the famous Montreal Neurological Institute. Experiments related to this, pseudoscience about so-called mystical experience. And well, for her and for my former colleagues at the University of Montreal, everything has to be physical. It's the brain itself, something physical that creates mind and consciousness. And spiritual experiences are delusions, or UFOs cannot exist. They are delusions because it's not possible according to the materialist framework. So, you know, it was not possible to reach an agreement. So it was a bad marriage, really. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about science? Because I was at a university for 40 years. I wasn't a professor, but I dealt with academics. And I worked at a bar, the faculty club bar, for 2 years. And I got to know them like one-on-one, regular guys. And people, even somebody was sort of disputing yesterday, oh, nobody at the university would do this. Can you talk about the mindset of science today in terms of, and then go into your idea of your post-materialist manifesto and what happened there and where we are in terms of that? Because I think a lot of people still think that science is the place to be. I mean, they can make a cell phone, they can make a, you know, and stuff like that. And when you're around them, I think you've got the same experience, is it's not really what you think it is.
Not at all. No, it's clearly they are following an agenda, an ideology. It's guided by the materialist ideology, which is totally wrong. And but you have to, it's a game, a social game. It's done by humans. They have emotions, belief systems, and so on and so forth. And all the scientific system is built. Around this ideology, materialist ideology. So if you want to have, and they told me that, they tried to explain to me how it works. And if you want to receive, you want money, research money, grants, you want to climb the ladder, in universities, you want to be influential, you have to play this kind of game. You have to show publicly that you believe in this ideology. Otherwise, you're an heretic. You don't fit, and we're going to try to demolish you, expel you. And it's been done to many people before me. Sheldrake, and you know the story. It's very old. It started centuries ago with Galileo Galilei and all the. Yeah. So I was threatened. They literally they were bullying me, and they were telling me, you know, that we can play with your professional life. So you know what it means. Perhaps you won't have any salary next year if you don't do what we ask you to do, which is to follow this, to do mainstream science, to do, but that was basically, what I heard. And, you know, there's a fact. I met at the beginning of my career when I was quite young. I was still a student, a PhD student. I met with another famous neuroscientist, Henry, Dr. Jasper. He was a colleague of Dr. Penfield. They created Montreal Neurological Institute. So I told him about my visions, my plans, and said, oh my goodness, you cannot tell them that publicly, openly, because you will live a life of suffering and they will try to destroy you. So he was suggesting, keep this to you. You know, to yourself, don't say it. Otherwise, it was stronger than me because I had this strong sense of mission. My life plan had to be done at all cost, and so I decided to. You know, I didn't make any concession. I was, today some would say, well, that was a bit stupid because you know, or courageous, depends on the point of view, but I had to do that my way, you know. And
now in your book Expanding Reality, you talk about the fact that it sort of broke from this materialistic paradigm that started 1848 with the materialistic manifesto by Karl Marx. They actually broke with it, and you write about it in your book Expanding Reality about the early quantum physics guys, and then it suddenly got shut down by this famous expression, shut up and calculate. Can you talk a little bit about the fact that, remind people that there were the key guys were into this, yes, concept of consciousness as primary?
Yes. The founders of quantum physics, like Max Planck and Heisenberg, Schrodinger, Pauli, and Bohr, they were all mystical types of guys. They were all very spiritual, and they had to fight, you know, for the revolution in physics to succeed. It took about 30 years, from 1899 to about the beginning of 1930s, and so it was very difficult. But yeah, after that, the next generation of physicists, they were not at ease with, you know, the point of view, the world views of the founders of quantum physics. So they thought that, you know, they were a bit eccentric, and hence that the shut up and calculate Richard Feynman, for instance, and all those guys. But it's true that they've had their revolution, and now we're exactly in the same situation with regard to what we could call the new science of consciousness. Yeah. We are in a transition between, you know, the old materialist paradigm, which has been around and dominant for a few centuries, and the something new. My colleagues and I, we've called that a post-materialist paradigm, but that doesn't mean anything. It's only to mark a transition from an historical point of view, but what is it exactly? We didn't see. But what's interesting is that the more we progress with this new science of consciousness, and the more we can realize that we are converging with the old spiritual traditions, what they've been seeing for millennia. They didn't have the technology to conduct research, but they had other ways, you know, to have access to a certain truth. And so there's a convergence between science and spirituality. This post-materialist view of the world is in resonance with the old spiritual tradition. We know that. It's also very compatible with the discoveries of parapsychology, or, you know, psi phenomena research. And and everything about spiritual and mystical experiences. And also, it's compatible with a number of elements that we find in the UFO reports and experiences, which is very, very interesting too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It all seems to be the same, going into the same thing. It's this higher level of reality in terms of what's actually going on. People are making these assumptions. Mm-hmm. And it's like Max Planck had said, you know, science advances one funeral at a time. So sometimes yes, I play Richard Feynman doing his thing at Cornell in 1962, where he says, I'm a scientist and I know all about UFOs, flying saucers. There are no flying saucers. And it's like, and then it's like, well, Feynman's dead and science advances. And so you're sort of at the leading edge. Talk a little bit about the meetings that you guys had in terms of setting this thing up, in terms of who was involved in this. And are we getting somewhere? Are we actually moving into the next?
Oh, I think so. It was in 2000. Well, yeah. After I was expelled from the University of Montreal, I received an email from a guy named Gary Schwartz. I knew who he was, but I didn't knew him personally. And it's very strange. Gary Schwartz is he's a researcher in the Department of Psychology at the University of Arizona. But he's a great thinker himself, and he started to do research with mediums, but in laboratory, in very controlled situations, some nearly 30 years ago, and for about 10 years, he did that. And he told me something. He said in his email, there is a force, or I received a message to contact you. But I know your name, but I don't know what's happening with you. So he said, are you in need of something? What happened? So I called him right away, and I explained what just happened. And he said, well, at the University of Arizona, we would be very happy to have somebody like a black sheep like you. So I worked with him and also with other colleagues for 10 years. And the first thing that I did, it was about this idea of a meeting of people, of black sheeps in various fields, if you will, like Sheldrake in biology, and we had Larry Darcy in medicine, and Schwartz in psychology, Charles Tart, and you know, people like that. They were very well known, all famous in their own fields, but they were, you know, perceived as heretics by mainstream scientists. And so we were met in Tucson, and we decided to examine all the evidence showing that the materialist model of the world was flawed, and also the other lines of evidence showing that other lines of evidence helping us to create something new, a new paradigm. And so we met for a few days. And 3 months after the meeting, I took the lead of writing the manifesto for a post-materialist world. And so I wrote the first draft, and my colleagues helped me to, you know, to reach a version, a common version. We all agreed on the final version, and it was published. It was signed, because we opened it was open to the public and professionals. So it was signed by over 400 people. Wow. Some were famous scientists, but most of them were retired. So they were not afraid of the establishment. That's the difference. The younger ones, they were, you know, I understood that why. It was more difficult to attract younger scientists. But still, and after that, it was there was a guy working at the at NASA in the United States. He was a mathematician at the University of Virginia. He saw the manifesto, wrote a superb article, and compared us to the guys in physics, you know, at the beginning of modern physics, these pioneers. And he said, don't judge them rapidly. You don't know. They may be right. You know, you may think that they're a bunch of fools, but perhaps they are right. And that, you know, they are saying will lead to the next great revolution in science. And so after that, there were numerous translations all over the planet. And now I can tell you that I can go to any, I'm still traveling all over the world. At the beginning, when I started, let's see, 30 years ago, it was dangerous for me to say things in public. Some people were trying to attack me. It was the same thing for all these other guys. And it was very emotional. Sheldrake told me once that he was somebody, he was a knife to attack him, a student, wow. Because he was demonstrating that the theory of evolution, the mainstream theory of evolution, was wrong. And, you know, the students were brainwashed to believe in Darwin and only, you know, so now people were reacting violently. And that's why what happened to me a number of times. But I can tell you that today I can go to, you know, very prestigious institutions, conservative ones, and people will listen now and they won't react like that. And, you know, they may not agree, but at least they will listen, and they realize that the world is changing. There's a, you know, and if it's the general public, well, the general public is way in advance with regard to the academia, and so I realize that now the people globally on planet Earth, they're ready for a major shift in terms of worldview. That's what I feel.
Yeah. There was a shift. I know when I had my consciousness down, I had an experience basically told me it was consciousness. And I remember I got a lot of flack, but I think you would agree that things have sort of changed. Even Jill Bolte Taylor talks about her experience.
Right.
Where exactly. She says, like, academia, you did not talk about this kind of stuff. And now it's sort of like you can do it. Same with UFOs. Once the New York Times article came out, it sort of moved and everybody sort of said, yeah, me too, and joined in. Mm. So you think we're making some progress here, that we're moving along, and it's just a matter of waiting.
I feel it. And even my opponents back in time, scientists who were very critical of me, now they send me email saying, well, perhaps you were a visionary. I can feel that it's changing, and now it's possible to it's more possible in the academic world to talk, and also in the business sector to talk about consciousness and its powers, the levels, and so on. And so, yeah, more people are open-minded with regard to these issues.
Now, I wrote a book called Contact Modalities, where I talk about different things, channeling and mediumship and UFO experiences, all this kind of stuff. There's 70 different things, like you get in the field and you can pull material back out of the field and stuff like that. And one of the things I wrote a whole bit on was trauma. And you went through this as well, the whole idea of the near-death experience. Can you talk a little bit about your near-death experience and how it changed your life?
Yeah. It was 12 years after my vision when I was a child at 8 years old. I was at the beginning of my 20s, and I had been physically very healthy all of my life until then. And one morning I woke up and I was, my visual perception was altered, like if I was under the influence of drugs or toxins of some sort. All the body was hurting, and I didn't have energy. And so I had to go back to the place of my parents, and I stayed in a bed for about nearly a year. I was like somebody suffering from cancer, internal phase or AIDS. And the doctors didn't understand what was going on. And during that year, I've had a near-death experience. One night, I had the feeling of being pulled out of my physical body. Really. And then I met with a beautiful being of light. The reason was that I thought that my life was over. My physical life was over, and my life plan would not happen like what I perceived. So to me, it was a major failure. I didn't understand because it didn't fit with the experience when I was a child. And so I received explanations about that. I was thinking, to be honest, I was thinking about killing myself. I was starting to make plans. I was in a bad place, you know. And the being of light knew everything about all this. And I say he, but it was a she also. It was androgynous. But I'll say he. He tried to explain to me what was really happening. It was not the end of the road for me, not at all. But it was like part of a transmutation process of consciousness. That's what I received. And he gave me predictions about my life in the physical world because I remember my brain was attacked and I was very sick and the brain was not functioning properly. So I thought maybe it's an hallucination, a delusion, or because I had started my studies. So to prove to me that that was not the case, the being gave me three predictions for a few predictions for what would happen very soon in the physical world. And everything happened as predicted. And also, I saw a part of my future research program. And so when I came back, and he told me that I was going to be healed progressively, and that it was that I had signed for all of this, but I didn't remember. It was part of the life plan,
yeah,
believe it or not. But in that state, I saw it. I knew it was true. And so that's exactly what happened. I managed to heal, but it took a number of years to, you know, come back to health perfectly. 7 years after that, I saw a medical doctor, and I told him about all my experience and the problems. So he was a famous epidemiologist, and he was a biochemist. And he said, we should investigate your blood. And he asked me to investigate my blood. And he found three different types of viruses, viral infections. And they came from when I was very young. I skipped a few years at elementary school. And I arrived at university too young. So I decided to work. I went to work in Israel, and I worked at an hospital for children, handicapped children. I became sick, and that's where I contracted the viral infections. And based on what he saw in my blood, he said, you know, with such intensity in terms of the infections, most people that he had seen before that were dead or totally handicapped for the rest of their lives. So he said, I don't know how you made it. And then I told him about what happened. I asked him if he was open-minded enough to listen to my story. He said, yes, just before, because I didn't want him to be mad. Or he said, no, I'm open-minded. So I told him the story. He said, well, you see, you know, it's a... you've received a miracle, and in medicine we're very limited, and we don't understand everything. He was very honest as a medical doctor, and so that's what happened. And after that, I had to fight to return to the university because my supervisors, they thought that I was they were neurologists, they thought that I was perhaps schizophrenic or something like that. So I had to fight really to be reinstated, as a doctoral student. But it worked. And then after that, I started to implement the research program I downloaded. And so all the major studies that I've done in my career, I simply, you know, follow the plan, to be honest. Beautiful.
Now let's go to the stuff that you do. So I'm very interested in this, and I've followed it quite a bit with you. And the other one I watched was Andrew Newberg. Have you worked with him? Yeah. So you're doing the same.
That's
sort
work,
of thing
but
that,
yes,
you're
I know.
The same sort of work. Yeah. Where you put people in machines. And this is where I always point out to people, because people won't believe that the mind changes the brain. They'll think, no, the brain makes the mind. And so you did some experiments that actually showed the plasticity of the brain. Can you get into that and the importance of what that shows?
Oh, well, yes. I was the first, for instance, I was the first one in the late 90s to beginning of 2000 to use functional brain imaging. Functional resonance brain imaging to demonstrate that we have the capacity to self-direct brain activity with regard to emotions. So what we were doing is that we were inducing strong emotional states using, for instance, at the beginning in my first study, I did we used pornographic film clips and with young guys and students, and so we were seeing massive reaction in the emotional portion of the brain. But what was interesting is that we asked them also in another condition, experimental condition, to become detached observers of the film clips, but also of their own arousal, their own subjective feelings as well. And all the massive activation in the limbic system, the emotional brain, totally vanished. And so that was the beginning of the field of research about emotion regulation. But I wrote a paper after that, and the title was Change the Mind and You Change the Brain. And so I was following this line of research. And at first, even if it was a sensational discovery, I had trouble publishing because it didn't fit with the reigning paradigm, the dominant paradigm. Yeah. So they were asking me to change the title, for instance, reframe the interpretation, but I didn't want to do that because that was the truth. And then I followed with a series of experiments about what's happening. I studied contemplative nuns, Carmelites nuns, and during a mystical state and
What did that show? Because that's an interesting one. What did that show?
Well, in neurology and neuroscience, scientists believe that there was a God spot in a portion of the brain that we call the temporal lobe, and that, you know, these experiences, spiritual, mystical, call them as you want, they were simply delusions created by an abnormal pattern of electrical activity in this portion of the brain. But what we demonstrated is that there was no single God spot in the brain, that these experiences were correlated with a complex network of brain regions, and it was replicated by other laboratories. And we studied also near-death experiencers who could still reconnect with the light or the being of light that they had met. And the networks in the brain were quite similar, whether the people were saying we met the light, the experiencer, or the nuns that were saying it's God, you know, the Christian concept of God. It didn't seem, or even Buddhist monks who were talking of the void with capital V.
Yeah.
The patterns were quite similar in the brain, in the physical brain. So, and that's how I became known internationally after these experiences. And but at first, like I said before, they thought that I was perhaps, they didn't know if I was, they thought I was a kind of freak or, you know. And then after that, I started to be, when my research became more influential, then I started to be attacked by the materialists. They were attacking me. They took control of the Wikipedia page, for instance. Somebody created a negative Wikipedia page about me. They made me look like a fool.
And they use the word pseudoscience all the time.
Yes,
that's they what love they that do. Word.
Exactly.
Yeah,
but
what a lot of people don't realize. The Wikipedia is they call themselves the guerrilla skeptics. And take over like your page and Sheldrake's page. And discredit you on Wikipedia. And you can't change it. If you try to change it, you get banned and you can't change the page. It's just,
I try.
Don't believe this is going on.
But it's true, absolutely true. I experienced it myself. I tried to change it. It took two minutes to, and I received a warning, and it came back to the original version. So, yeah. And they told me, if you're not happy with it, try to sue us.
Yeah.
You have an army of lawyers ready to, you know.
Amazing. Can I ask a question? Did the University of Arizona do mediums in the MRIs? And what did that show?
No, they didn't do mediums. No.
Yeah, because I've always found this interesting. The one I had asked Newberg to do, and he needed funding to do it, but it was in the UFO community, suddenly appeared these people doing what we call light language. They speak this light language. I'm going like, what? I never heard this. You know, I've been in a long time, and suddenly these people appeared, and like, where did these people come from? And it would be very interesting to find that. And so, whatever is happening, these people are able to recreate this pattern. It shows you that what everybody wants is this physical, this data. Like, show me something on paper that you were able to show this, that there is these states. And the thing with the brain plasticity, maybe go over the idea that with meditation and stuff, that the brain actually changes, that you can actually change the structure of the brain, the size, and that sort of thing.
Yes, we did studies in my lab, and also it's been done, this type of study, by many labs around the world. And now it's very clear that, you change the patterns of activation or deactivation of various brain regions. But not only that, you change the actual structure in terms of gray matter and white matter. Absolutely. Yeah, and very, very rapidly, after only a few weeks of training, you can already see significant changes.
Wow. And the theta state, you wrote about the theta state, which I found when I did my contact modalities, the importance of this theta state in terms of getting there, finding a way to get there. Or what did you do in terms of that? And what did you find out with this frequency?
Well, I discovered that, and now I'm doing private research, but I've developed a psycho-spiritual approach based on this discovery, because the theta waves, and especially the junction of the delta waves and the theta waves, so around 3.54 hertz or cycle per second, they are associated with expanded states of awareness. And so the closer you are of 0 hertz, and because that's what we see in clinical death, when the heart stops, the breathing stops, and then if you're measuring electrical activity of the brain with an EEG, you see that the line becomes flat within generally 15 to 20 seconds, and we see that the EEG is isoelectric then. So it's clinical death. But what I found is that to help people reach expanded states of awareness without having to die, you have to bring them, you know, at the junction of the theta and delta junction. But at the same time, it's hard to for them to remember in that kind of state and to not fall asleep. So what I'm doing, I've developed a procedure, and when they are in that kind of state, I'm using pulses of gamma waves, which are also related to attention and clarity of mind. And so that's a way to keep these people aware. And after the session or after the exercise, they can bring back the information that they have received. And so I've created an approach that is called holosynthesis, H-O-L-O-synthesis. So it's, and I'm doing that. I've been to Switzerland, for instance, a few months ago. I've introduced people over there about that. I've done some sessions in Quebec, and now I'm going to go to France next spring also. Because I have discovered that without being experts on meditation and contemplation, like Carmelite nuns or Buddhist monks, normal people can have access to other levels of consciousness and information. You don't need to be a phenomenon, you know, an Olympic star of meditation or contemplation to do that. And we see that with the experiencers, you know, in UFO so-called abductions.
And so this is like the almost like the hypnopompic state where you're going into sleep and coming out of sleep, that very where people always say, oh, if you can stay alert there and not move your finger and let the left brain come back online, you can pick up stuff. So that's where you have you got a technique that you're going to bring into the public that, people can use?
Yes, I'm using sounds embedded within you know, we can call that music, but it's not really music. It's more like a breathing generated by synthesizers. So it's I'm using that, and also some guidance, a bit like we do in hypnosis, but very minimal guidance. And the results are amazing. And very often, the people will encounter sometimes deceased people, friends, or old friends, or family, but often they meet with so-called aliens.
Wow. Yeah. Have you got, can you send me a link for that if you, if they, you've got that up? And because I would love to, a lot of people do the Monroe Institute stuff. They've always followed that, and you're doing a different sort of frequency.
I discovered at the Monroe Institute, they thought that it was better to, you know, send different frequencies in both ears at the same time, and the auditory system subtracts the frequencies. And but it's much simpler. We use the same frequency for both ears, which means you don't have to wear
the headset,
a headset, for instance. And it's even it's very simple, but very powerful. And I like that very much, because myself, we don't have time to talk about it today, but I've had myself experience with what appeared to me to be aliens. Tall blondes.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
35, 40 years ago, I would say. Wow. For several times during during dreams. But they were not feeling like dreams at all, because I could, you know, I could see the ship on board. And now I'm not, you know, shocked to say that publicly, because my career is behind me academically. But it was a fascinating experience.
Wow, that's fascinating. It's almost like the crossover. Like sometimes people will say, well, I don't think I was abducted. I just have them in the dreams. And then I always say, anything else weird happening in your life? They go, oh, yeah, I'm just telling you. But and that's the thing. You have all these experiences as a child, the near-death experience. It's like you attract this. Your frequency moves up, and you start encountering this stuff because you've moved. A couple more questions, because I got to let you go. The gamma thing you did on the gamma thing, like University of Wisconsin did that whole thing with the gamma with the monks. Did you do that as well?
And we saw some gamma. Well, they saw the gamma waves. The high frequency waves around, in their case, it was around 80 hertz, 80 to 100 hertz. And we saw the same thing in the Carmelite nuns as well. And it is associated with deep meditative states. Yeah.
Now, I wrote a book on psilocybin. I call it the psilocybin school. And so you had some experiences with whatever you want to call them. Can you basically describe it? Did you go in there just to sort of learn something? And can you talk about, did you run across some higher intelligence? Did you learn something? Was it useful? Oh. And
it was very useful, because I did that a number of times. I think perhaps 5-6 times throughout my life. But most of the times I was experiencing what they call ego death. So your little self vanishes for
a
while.
It's a little traumatic, yeah.
Yeah, at first, yes. Yeah. When I first experienced that, I was a bit worried. But after that, I got used to it, because I've experienced it quite often. Well, perhaps 5 times. And so the little selves vanish, and you become, in my case, I became more one with what we could call the source. you know, universal consciousness or cosmic consciousness or whatever. And it felt really good. And the source taught me certain things. So there was still some duality for a while. And but during these experiences also, after a while, after I'd received the teachings, we would become totally one. So I was not able to distinguish what was me from, you know, what was not me. It was a total unitive state of consciousness. But it would be very difficult to live like that in the day-to-day physical world.
Absolutely. Wonderful. Absolutely spectacular. And so maybe the last question, and then people can go. I highly recommend that people watch your material, because in the UFO field, I mean, there's me and maybe only me or one other person that's got this consciousness connection. So I think people need to follow somebody who's an expert. I think you're sort of an expert. You've done this your whole life. You've done sort of the machine stuff that people can see. There's actual data that it's not like just some idea or whatever like that. So what are you doing right now? Have you got a lab in Arizona? Are you still associated with the University of Arizona?
It's came to an end during the summer 2022. So it's been over a year now. And what I'm doing is I'm developing my own psycho-spiritual approach that we call holosynthesis. Okay. And so now I'm trying to teach other people to use that, because we're seeing beautiful results. People can be helped. You know, people are suffering emotionally a lot because they live at the level of their own little self, their ego. But what I found, I'm not the first one to discover that, if you're reaching expanded states of awareness and you look at the same traumatic events, the emotional charge is not there at all. It's canceled. So you can, and in that way, you can rewire your own mind and your own brain. And I'm also trying to help other people to live what I have experienced myself in my life, to help people have access to what I call the greater self, you know, compared to the little self, or, you know, through this approach. I'm giving workshops and, you know, lectures, and I'm still writing books, but basically that's what I'm doing right now. And I'm in the process of creating my own institute.
Beautiful. Yeah. Well, yeah. I will link everything, anything that comes up, I'll watch you and I'll link everything, because I think your stuff is extremely important. So last question, then we'll call it a day. What would be your take on where did we come from? Where are we going? And what are we supposed to be doing while we're here? What would be your overall take on what the meaning of life from what you've learned?
From what I've learned? To rediscover who you are truly. Yeah. That is the source of everything. I have a non-dual perspective.
Yeah,
based on all these experiences, yeah, and on Earth, where what we're living, we believe in our own avatars, and it seems very real. And but to me, it's like the grand theater of life. It's life after death is more real to me than life in the physical world. And when you're back in the source, it's even more real than life after death. And so there are levels, you know, of levels of consciousness, perception, and so on and so forth. But we're gaining, you know, we're creating our own theater, and we're gaining experiences. We are learning things throughout this, and the source is storing everything about this. And for whatever reason, that I'm not sure, but we can speculate about that. But that's about my understanding at this present time.
Well, you got sort of chosen, and I think you were working your mission, and I really appreciate your sharing with me and the people that follow me, who will understand what you're talking about. Because the way I look at it is like the World Cup or the Super Bowl. We are living in the game. Most people don't even know the game is going on. They live lives of quiet desperation. So you're what, sort of a light to the world, and especially with the manifesto, you've sort of, it's like a revolution that this is people can move in that direction, and it's a new world. And thank you for what you do.
Thanks to you.
Beautiful. Okay, and maybe we'll do it again sometime when you when you want to promote something, just let me know. I'm gonna make sure that people know how to find you, because you're on the leading edge of where I think everybody has to go in terms of understanding what's actually going on here. So thank you very much for your time, and let's do it again sometime.
Thank you, Grant.
Okay.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.